Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we've all heard the money can't buy happiness argument. And I've always thought that was a bunch of bunk. Money might not be able to buy happiness, but at least buy a little stability. Maybe a little sanity. Just a thought. And that usually comes from people who have money. Sadly, you ask somebody who's struggling to keep a roof over their head or food on the table, and they'll tell you a completely different story, which is why when I came across this article over at Forbes magazine, which right in line with everything I've been saying for almost every moment I've been doing this show, the article titled Unions Not Companies Deliver Real Stability, Real Stable Financial Security. Of course it does. That's why I've asked its author, Christian Weller, to come talk with us. Christian is a professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, also a senior fellow over at the Center for American Progress. Christian, thanks for taking time for us.
Always fun to talk to you, Rick.
So you start off your article with the premise that I've made all the time. Nothing is given. There's no benevolent employers. Everything is demanded and fought for and negotiated for, and we need more of it.
That's correct. And we need to fight back at this point against the employer saying that they are willing to be more benevolent. And we have now seen sort of the business roundtable, and we've seen some of the business-friendly advocacy groups saying, well, let the employers do a little bit more, and it's good for the workers, it's good for the bottom line. And yeah, maybe, but clearly, why should we all of a sudden start trusting businesses, large corporations that have ripped off the American working class for 30, 40 years, just because now they actually need to pay a little bit more. They may change their mind here and there, but in the end, it's only when workers band together in a union that we get sort of real sustained wealth. And I'm not saying this just from a political perspective, because I believe in unions and believe that's right. My colleague David Madeline and I have actually done the research on this, and we cite that in this article. We've looked at Federal Reserve Bank data broken down by union members versus non-union members, and it turns out that union members have a lot more wealth than non-union members, and typically because they have more stable jobs.
Right. And, you know, and they end up making higher wages. The union advantage is about 30% higher in compensation, along with much better health care benefits that give health security, and also, something still of a defined benefit, still today even a little defined benefit, which leads to retirement security. So ultimately, not to mention job security as well, where you can't just be fired for being at will.
All of those factors. Let me just say, we actually control for income levels in our research, and the union wealth premium is about 70% to 80%, depending on which time period you're looking at. So there's a much larger gap on the wealth side than there is on the income side, and that holds true even after you control for income. So there is something here, and we've now looked at this in multiple different ways. What are the mechanisms that lead to it? Yes, there is higher income, but the other part is also unions negotiate for other benefits, and one of them, there are a number of benefits. One of them, as you mentioned, are defined benefit pensions. They play an important role. But the other mechanisms that we often overlook is unions provide safety and stability. You're no longer an employee at will. When the employer changes their mind, there is a mechanism to individually talk about an individual employee. Or there is also a mechanism when an employer sort of says, okay, well, business is going down, how are we going to handle that? There is a mechanism to negotiate over that, and that shows up in the numbers. The average length with an employer is about 50% longer for union members than for non-union members.
Right.
And that translates into a lot more sanity, as you said. People can breathe a lot easier. They can plan a lot more. They're much more willing to then put money into an emergency savings account and kids' college funds, and they also end up saving more in a 401k, for instance.
Yeah, I remember I worked for a trucking company for a number of years, and it was a unionized company, and obviously we made really good wages and benefits and all that. And the company actually made the argument all the time to customers that we have a very stable workforce. They had less than a 2% turnover rate of this nationwide corporation. They were proud of that. You know, they were proud of the fact that, you know, they had people there who were stable, and, you know, and they made that part of their sales pitch. Somehow that's changed over the last 20 years to the point where now that's almost a liability, I think.
It is a liability if you're running a company where you're constantly chasing after the next quarter's profits and you need to keep your CEO's stock options happy and high. But it's definitely not a liability when you're actually trying to run a real business, not just manipulating the stock market. And this might seem like sort of overstating the case, but you look at the numbers, right? When you look at corporate data, for the past 30 years, corporations have used every single dollar in after-tax profits to buy back their own shares or pay out dividends. There is not much left over for workers. No. And that business model is sort of coming to an end. Profits have been going down in a slowing economy amid the trade wars. And the only way businesses are now figuring out how to be profitable is basically make stuff again and sell more of the stuff. And that means they need more workers and they need to pay them better. And that sort of leads to these arguments that employers will do the right thing by workers and we should just be happy with that.
I don't buy that.
Yeah, and we shouldn't, because just as quickly as it comes, it will go. And I think we do need, if we want to have a real middle class, not just with higher wages, but also with secure wealth, where people have and can afford their home, where they can look forward to a secure retirement, where they can look forward to spending time with their family. That only comes through a strong labor movement.
Yeah, well, I've always said that I don't want employer-based health care. I don't want to see the employers hold on to pensions. I would love, for instance, you know, as a Teamster, the Teamsters hold my pension and our health care through joint plans. And while there may be some problems, I still think it's better than having all of that tied to the employer. And don't we have to move to a system away from employer-based health care? Because, I mean, I think the GM strike was a perfect example. You know, the people went on strike. The first thing the GM did was, we're cutting your health care.
Right. So the employer-based model, I mean, the employers don't like it.
Well, if the employers don't like it, Christian, and I hear this a lot, why the hell do they fight so hard to keep it? Aren't they out there pushing for an alternative to get it off of their back? Because I'll tell you, I, as an employer, don't want to have to search out those benefits either. So why do we still have this system?
Because we don't have a good alternative. Where the employers are nervous is with the multi-employer plans, that if I'm like an employer and I go into the multi-employer plan and I do my thing and then one of the other employers goes under, I'm on the hook for that. There is a little bit of that where the employers are nervous about this. But we have seen in several cases in the last 20 years sort of big employers joining actually multi-employer plans, among the airlines, for instance, in the early 2000s. The other part is there is definitely sort of employers, especially in the airlines, were eager to get rid of their pension plans. And if there was a multi-employer plan, what may be a Teamsters plan or maybe a machinist plan or something like that, they would go in there. Otherwise, the only way for them to really get rid of the pension plan was to say, like, I'm going to stop the pension and I'm going to offer a 401k plan instead. And that is, to some degree, a policy failure. We're rather unimaginative. You can actually stand up what we call sort of benefit platforms outside of the employer world. And in fact, that is, and you don't have to have this necessarily be a joint trustee plan. You can have union members in there and you can have non-union members in it. That's completely doable.
Right. I look at what California is doing, what CalPERS is doing in California, opening up the state system to other employers, to smaller employers, to give access to pension plans to their members. I think that's a step in the right direction.
And there is actually an industry group that has been advocating for these benefit platforms. And there would be sort of basically, think sort of like a business that offers health plans and offers defined benefit pensions and other things, and employers, unionized and non-unionized, can join there. And then it's off the employer's plate, and you have stable benefits for everybody. And I think the employers like it because they do understand, at least sort of the smarter employers understand, that the peace of mind that comes from a stable retirement benefit is worth something. Obviously, the peace of mind that comes from having a stable job is worth more, but for that, you do need to have a union in the workplace. But if we want to have sort of real wealth security, we also need to maintain good retirement benefit pensions, in particular defined benefit pensions.
Because I know you've done the research on this, but you have to imagine that productivity and loyalty to the company comes with having good wages, having stable benefits, having stable employment. That just seems like common sense to me. So when I saw, and you alluded to the business.
That's why we have pensions.
What's that?
That's why we have pensions. Employers didn't offer, and a lot of employers don't offer pensions just because of their goodwill. They offer it in high-skilled workforces because they want the workers. And in many cases, think about sort of teacher pensions. They exist because the school systems want to hang on to experienced teachers.
Right. But, you know, what I was saying is, you know, you alluded to the business roundtable, the epiphany that they've recently had that, you know, the consumer matters, that the community matters, and that, oh, by the way, the workers seem to matter now, that it's no longer all about maximizing shareholder wealth and hooray for me and screw everybody else. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, they came out with this statement. And because, you know, I think the rest of us have known that they could care less about their customers or their workers or the community. And I don't think going forward it's going to get any better.
No, and I wasn't quite sure whether I should laugh or cry at that statement. Because we've known this and we've fought back at this and we said, like, this is an unsustainable model. And now the business roundtable is like, trust us, we'll fix these things. And I was like, no, you've had your chance. And I think the going forward for us, the real solution is, okay, how do we really strengthen the labor movement? How do we protect unions? How do we protect workers? How do we get unions into, and union rights and collective bargaining rights, into what we call sort of the precarious or fissured workplace, sort of the gig economy? And I think what's been happening out on the West Coast, that SEIU won the rights to unionize, the home health aides, I think that's a big signal. I think that teachers are walking off the jobs all across the country. I think those are big signals that there is real hope for the labor movement.
Yeah, but ultimately, for me, it comes back to these are political decisions. You know, it's the people that we put into the halls of power, the people we put into Congress and the Senate. You know, I look at right now, there was some hope that Virginia, having turned blue, would undo the right to work nonsense that's been there. And now I'm seeing, well, maybe that's not going to happen.
I don't know, but you're right. I can't predict the future, and I've like learned my lessons not to do that. But the other part is, I think you're right. This is all a political decision. It was a political decision from previous administrations to go against the labor movement, not to protect workers' rights, not to enforce labor law when the opportunities exist. But then I also look at some of the campaigns at this point, the presidential campaigns, and I do have hope because there are innovative new ideas coming out. There are people pushing, and it doesn't feel like the same old lip service that Democratic candidates in particular pay to the labor movement. I think there is some real thought being put into, okay, what does a renewed labor movement, what does a renewed labor law look like in a changed workflows?
And, you know, the thing is, I know people who have been in business for years and years, and I think back to an uncle who has had a business since the 60s. The first thing that he did when he started his business, he went to the local union and said, organize my workforce. I want them to have benefits. I want them to have, you know, decent wages. I want them to be part of and this, have the security of the job and all that. And I think, you know, back to that era of this is a guy who was starting a business and wanted a partnership with his workforce. Now that doesn't happen today.
I'm not sure. I think there is sort of it's weird to me. When I listen to employers, especially in the high-skill workforce, they're like, well, and then this engineer and that worker comes to me and complains, and I don't want to deal with that. And I'm like, well, if you had a union, you didn't have to deal with this.
Right.
There is going to be an HR person on the management side, and there's going to be a union rep, and they're working it out, and you don't have to deal with it. But if you don't have a union, if you don't have a collective bargaining voice, you constantly have to deal with individual cases. And many people will be employed at will, but when you're talking higher skilled workforces, you don't want to necessarily get rid of people because turnover is incredibly costly. Skilled work is very valuable. So you deal with this, and it's an incredible cost to the employer. So I don't understand why employers aren't more open, and I think there is sort of a ideology here that has emerged over the last, since the 1980s probably, that unions are bad, that has sunk in with employers, even against their own self-interest when, as you said, unions create more stable workforces. It right. streamlines the labor management process, all of these things. We know that. The literature shows us that. And as I said, the data shows us that in the end you have a more financially secure labor force that then translates into a more productive labor force. And I think there is, it's not just politics, but I think there is ideology also plays into it, and it will take some time to turn the tide on that.
Right, but while you're talking about all those good things, at the end of the day, the CEO views his workplace as his kingdom. He's the king, and they're the serfs. Do what I say, or there's the door. That seems to me to be the driving motivation, and all those other things he'll do without, because ultimately they want to have final say. And look, unions want to have their workforce have a voice on the job.
That's true. But I think we're sort of the interest the line at this point is profits. They're high, but they haven't grown much in the last 2 years, and that's in the end what companies are worried about, right. especially their stock options. And so if you want to grow your business and you want to increase your profits, you have to start really going back to your core business and actually making more stuff and become more productive. Productivity is a real challenge, has become a real challenge in the last few years. Whatever companies thought they can do, like as you said, use their workers as more sort of a disposable thing in their kingdoms or fiefdoms, that's no longer working. And I think there is sort of a slow rethinking going on. I think unions can sort of push that along further and can also secure that and put a new sort of model in place when there is a union. As I said, like I think that my biggest fear is that some companies like the Business Roundtable people changing their mind now, and as soon as things
turn south,
it doesn't have to be south. If like somebody, who knows what the Business Roundtable will decide next year in their joint statement?
That's
right?
A good point.
This is a club of multimillionaires and billionaires. Whatever they decide over lunch, that's ultimately what is going to drive. Yeah. And what we're interested in, what I think the country is interested in, is building a real working class. And a strong and stable working class, and we can't wait for the Business Roundtable to finally act on the newfound goodwill towards working families.
I'm right there with you, because you know what I know every one of those CEOs has? They have an employment contract.
Oh yeah, and a golden parachute.
And I know what most workers in this country don't have? An employment contract with a golden parachute.
Yes, it is.
So for me, that's
our world.
I'll take what you've got, please. I don't want to take yours away. I just want to make sure that everyone gets a little piece of it. Last question I've got for you. You look at the whole financial stability thing. Is there an area somewhere where we've kind of said this is what financially stable looks like? Thoughts?
Well, what do you mean? Like, in terms
like economically?
Of household?
I think you threw some numbers out in the article that caught my attention. I think it was like 36. Was it 33,000? You said was anyone around there was experiencing negative income via negative income?
Yeah, I mean, largely that's sort of our biggest problems. I mean, it's hard to pin down exactly the numbers, the thresholds, because income volatility and income instability, sort of the what we call income shocks, negative income shocks, have actually moved up. So in the past, it used to be sort of lower income people. At this point, on average, about 20% of American families experience a negative income shock in a year. And that has moved up the income scale from like low income to middle income. And that sort of is driving a lot of anxiety. That has these negative follow-on effects. If you're constantly worried, okay, well, am I going to lose my job? Am I going to lose my overtime? Am I going to see my hours being cut back at my employer? that makes it much harder to plan for the future. That makes it much harder to save, and that sort of translates into less wealth. And right. as I said, like for us, for David, Madeline, and I, in our research, the sort of the really thing that stands out is the only way, like one entryway to really get to a point of financial security is job stability in collective bargaining is a major mechanism to create job stability, predictable schedules, predictable work schedules, and the ability that if things don't work out, you actually have a way to negotiate with your employer. You're not just being kicked out on the street.
Yeah, excellent points, all of the above. I hope people will take a look at the article in Forbes magazine, Unions, not companies, deliver real sustainable financial security, written by our friend Christian Weller. Christian, I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope you come back and talk with us real soon.
Anytime, Rick. Thank you very much for having me.
Good stuff, as always. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.